From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, Milwaukee hosts some pioneers in the recreational trail movement this week. We'll find out what they're doing here.
Then why writer and Milwaukee native Dan Coyce had no trouble getting people to talk about the making of the play Angels in America 25 years ago.
What a new junior hockey team in Milwaukee hopes to accomplish by moving here.
All of these players maintain their NCAA eligibility. All of these players have aspirations of playing college hockey. Our job is to help them get there.
And how a Midwestern teenager's obsession with the golden age of Hollywood turned into a book 40 years later.
So here we were, literally June of 1978. We made this first sojourn via St. Paul to Los Angeles to interview the screen legends Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Around a year and a half ago, leaders of the National Rails to Trails Conservancy unveiled the groundwork for an ambitious network of recreational trails around southeastern Wisconsin. The plan, in conjunction with the Wisconsin Bike Federation, was called the Route of the Badger, and it would encompass hundreds of miles of new and existing trails around the region.
This week, people involved in that effort will host dozens of counterparts from similar trail projects in other metropolitan areas around the country in the first so-called Trail Nation Summit. Willie Caritas is the Route of the Badger program manager in Milwaukee for the Rails to Trails Conservancy, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mitch.
So there is a lot facing people in this city, the state, this country, and the world, really, right now. And I dare say, if you look at the top stories in the news, whether it's radio or TV or the newspaper, trail networks might not register with a lot of people. So looking at the state of things, why would you contend that a trail network like the Route of the Badger matters?
Trails are a way to get outside. And in today's world, people spend a lot of time in front of screens. And the more time we can get people outside, the more time we can get people connected to the outdoors, the better off we are. Because you got to get out to know what it's all about.
This is an effort, this particular network that's being planned. It's been underway for some time. Can you remind us what the goal for the Route of the Badger is?
Currently, in the seven southeast counties of Wisconsin, there's 340 miles of trails. And a lot of these trails, like the Oakleaf, the Hank Aaron, the Eisenbahn, the Interurban, they go certain places, but some of them are fairly autonomous. So they're not connected to each other. What we want to do with the Route of the Badger is to connect the trails so you create a network of trails. And so we've done some preliminary work and figure that if we can build an additional 160 miles of trails to connect those 340 miles of trails, we'll have a network in all seven southeast counties. And people will be able to get on the trails and just keep going.
Well, so connect the dots for us. What does getting outside do to address, you know, the myriad of other issues? What would you hope the upshot of people, you know, getting outside and using these trails more would be?
There's a variety of things. One, just getting out and getting on the trails, whether you're walking or rollerblading or biking, walking your dog, you get exercise. And so that's good for health. Obviously. And so, and recreation, you know, it's good to ride your bike and after a long day to get outside and to go someplace and see some new things. Also, it's a way for a lot of people in today's world, fewer and fewer people have cars. They're relying on public transportation or taking bikes to get to their place of work, to the grocery store, to the doctor. And so trails help to connect you to those places of employment and life.
Can you give us a status update? What sort of momentum exists for the route? And, you know, where has it come since, you know, the days that it was first proposed?
Right now, we are finalizing the map, and the map is really the most important step because we have to work with all seven counties in the southeast Wisconsin and the cities and the villages and find out what routes they want included in the Route of the Badger. And so then, once we have the routes distinguished, then we can work on with the individual municipalities and go about acquiring the right-of-ways, because sometimes it's very difficult. And this is the long game, because there's a reason that these trails aren't here now. And so, and one is because a lot of these railroad corridors are very expensive. So, you know, it's a journey. But in order to get to a place, you have to start. And so we're working really hard in defining these corridors, and we're just about finished with that.
Well, and given that this is a project of the Rails to Trails Conservancy, is that one of the prerequisites for finding this connective tissue? Do they have to be existing railroad corridors?
No, not at all. They can be. They can be railroad corridors that are very slightly used. But if they're used, what that means, it's a rail with trail. So that means that it's an active railroad and or a railway with a trail next to it. And right here in Milwaukee, there's the KK River Trail. And so that's got the main line, the main Amtrak line in between Chicago and Milwaukee, and it runs right on the side of it.
At what point does the search for funding mechanisms become part of this?
Well, I think we're always looking for funding, and I think that we're always trying to find partners who have an interest in trail systems. You know, really, when you look at trails, there's a whole economic driver to this as well. And so you have, like, for instance, the Hank Aaron Trail. Look at Menominee Valley and how it has just exploded and become this real jewel. And Three Bridges Park, and the Hank Aaron Trail weaves right through it. And a lot of businesses are attracted to that trail because they want, their workers are asking for it. They want to be on a trail so they can bike to work or walk to work or run to work.
So as we're having this conversation, this trail summit is getting underway.
You bet.
What do you stand to gain from having a variety of people from a variety of projects all in one place?
Well, what's really cool about it is that we have, this is an invite-only summit. So we've got the Route of the Badger is one of our Trail Nation projects, the Rails to Trails Conservancy's Trail Nation projects. We've got 8 of these projects. So Route of the Badger is one. We've got 7 other projects. They're all here in Milwaukee. And then we've got the Trail Nation Collaborative. And so there's 12 other cities who are doing the exact same kind of work. So we've got all of these leaders here in Milwaukee celebrating trails and sharing ideas. And so it's because it really hasn't been done before. It hasn't been looked at holistically. Let's look at trails as a way of connecting trail systems all together.
Are there other cities that are further along in the process that that you might be looking at as a blueprint?
Yeah, in Washington, D.C., they've got a really extensive network. We've got a project in Baltimore that's really moving forward. There are a lot of great cities out there that really get it. And they found that it's really good for their cities and good for bringing young people in who want to be in bike-friendly communities.
I know the D.C. area, for example, has a fairly robust regional planning commission, or, you know, regional recreation commission, the Maryland National Capital Parks and Planning Commission. How important is it to have, you know, a regional approach?
Oh, boy. It's so one of our primary partners, besides the Wisconsin Bike Fed, who are co-partners in this effort. So your question, SewerPAC, the Southeast Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission, they've been really active. Well, they came up with a plan called Vision 2050. And Vision 2050 is a plan for all 7 Southeast counties. And it addresses, one of the things that they address in there are trails and where they want to be by 2050. And so this is an effort to, they wrote the big overarching plan, but now we're working on the plan to actually actualize the plan, 2050. And so a lot of the goals that they've stated in Vision 2050 are coming into fruition with the Rod of the Badger.
Is there some thought given to, I mean, and let me think of the most delicate way to ask this question, but, you know, I would imagine there would be a lot of people that hear this kind of discussion and they would say, well, you know, this is an indelicate way to put it, but, you know, another opportunity for upper middle class white people to ride their expensive bikes.
Yeah.
How do you address the you know, the more ecumenical nature of trail usage, if you will?
Well, one of the things that we developed last year, actually it was June of last year, was the Reconnecting Milwaukee study. And it's right online, and everybody can have access to it. And we were looking at the social equity lens because we've noticed that as well. The Oak Leaf Trail, you know, surrounds Milwaukee. It's a fantastic, beautiful trail. How can we connect the Oak Leaf Trail with other potential trails that run through Milwaukee? Well, another one is the 30th Street Corridor. Now, the 30th Street Corridor essentially runs from Hampton Avenue south along 30th Street or right next to it, and then it kind of weaves through past Lisbon to through past Harley, past Miller Coors, and then ends there. Well, that trail, if that were to be developed, that would run through the heart of very poor neighborhoods. And so that's one of the trail projects that we're looking at. And so we're looking at it, but really the community has to look at it. And so we're working with different community organizations in Milwaukee that live and work within that area and enlisting their help. And so they're very interested in it as well because it's an economic driver again. If that trail is built, there's opportunities for more jobs in those areas. And so with the understanding that the trail is going to attract new businesses to that area.
In that way, I think people are obviously looking at that corridor as potentially the next Menominee Valley.
Yeah, and I think that there's potential for that. And see, what I think you have to do at the front end is you have to address housing and you have to address the questions of whether or not the community really wants it. And they have to embrace that trail, this trail project, because they're the ones who live in and around and next to it. So they're going to be the ones who are primarily using the trail. So if there's no interest in the trail, well, then you shouldn't do it. But if there is interest in it, then you should go forward and try to do it.
So why does this project resonate so strongly with you?
Well, I think back to what I said earlier, you know, I really believe in getting outside. I spent 27 years in Alaska, but I'm from Milwaukee. I grew up on the south side and have always been, you know, riding my bike and getting out. You know, I'm of the generation that's what we did. We kind of got up and during the summertime, you came home for dinner, you know, and then you went outside again. So I believe in that.
Willie Caritas, thank you so much for your time and best of luck with your work.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Willie Caritas is program manager for the Root of the Badger, Milwaukee Place host this week to the first Trail Nation Summit. You can find a link to more about it at WUWM.com.
A Milwaukee native helps chronicle the origins of one of the most important theater works of the 20th century. We'll talk with him when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Time.
And I'm Bonnie North. As Pride Fest kicks off tomorrow night, it's sometimes hard to remember a time when not being straight was seldom talked about in the mainstream. One of the key works that changed things was Tony Kushner's 1993 play, or really two plays, called Angels in America. It won Tony Awards and the Pulitzer Prize, and it was later adapted into a star-studded and acclaimed HBO presentation.
Milwaukee native Dan Coyce and his co-author Isaac Butler tell the creation story of the play through hundreds of interviews with people involved in it. In a book that came out this year called The World Only Spins Forward. Coyce joined us via Skype from Northern Virginia back in March. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So this project actually started with an article you and your co-author, Isaac Butler, did for Slate, right?
Yeah, I'm an editor at Slate, and at the time I was the culture editor, which meant it was a lot easier to green light sort of high intensity, odd projects about plays than it might be at most magazines. But we, you know, we had the idea to celebrate what was then the 25th anniversary of the play's very first performance, of Angels in America's very first performance in San Francisco in 1991. And we knew that the play itself was sort of epic in scale and scope. And we had a hunch that its origin story was similarly epic, and thought it would be fun to tell that story, and specifically to get the people involved in it to tell the story themselves in oral history form. And we were right. The tale was epic, so epic, in fact, that it could not be contained in a mere 15,000-word Slate cover story, and we had to go bigger.
Well, and so it turned into an epic project for the two of you.
Yeah, so we spent about a year interviewing about 250 actors, writers, directors, critics, historians, cultural commentators, everyone we could find who had a hand in the creation or the perpetuation of Angels in America, as well as hours of interviews with Tony Kushner, the author of Angels in America. And then we assembled that into this book, which attempts to not only tell the complete story of this play, but to situate it in the greater cultural context of the AIDS epidemic of the 1980s, of the Reagan Revolution of the 1980s, and then how those things have both evolved into the present day, with AIDS now as a chronic but manageable disease for most people, and the Reagan Revolution as a chronic and unmanageable disease still striking America.
It's interesting. It reads very much like a documentary. I mean, you can really imagine jumping from one interview to the next. Why do you think, why was oral history such an appropriate way to tell the story as opposed to, you know, maybe a more conventional narrative, but just as epic a narrative?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is, very simply, we knew we were going to be talking to some of the best, you know, talkers on earth, people who love to argue and debate and hold forth. Someone like Tony Kushner, you know, famously, you ask him a question and you're going to get like a 20-minute disquisition in response. And at the end of it, you'll be like, I think you answered my question and also 100 other questions. And we were also talking to George Wolfe, the director of the original Broadway production, and Meryl Streep, who's a great talker, and Lin-Manuel Miranda, who's a great talker. You know, we just knew that we were going to be talking to all these people who were so great on their feet and who were so interesting to hear. And the idea of putting ourselves between our readers and those voices seemed crazy. You know, why not let them tell the story, since they are the ones who know the story the best? It's a dialectic. It's about voices arguing with each other about politics and love and life and romance and AIDS and gay life and being in the closet or coming out of the closet. And so it also seemed like we could honor that and bring that spirit to this work about the creation of that play by making our play a chorus of voices in argument with each other.
And I think you actually just answered my next question. But, you know, we should make the point that you and Isaac did these interviews over time. They are portrayed as these conversations or debates or what have you. But that's one of the values you added to this. You kind of create the dialogue. You create the structure of the conversation.
Right. That's a trick of editing. You know, we talked to someone in June who has one version of the story of how Angels in America became two plays instead of one. Then we talk to someone else in August who has a completely different version of that story. Then we talk to someone in October who has a third different version of that story. And when you put those stories next to each other, you realize that those three worldviews on this very tiny little subject are in opposition to each other. And in telling them together, you create a much broader picture of how those early years of Angels are remembered differently depending on who has what agenda, how they remember differently based on who has a stake in that decision and who has a stake in not telling who really had that decision. And you get the sense of how conflict-filled even the tiniest decisions were in the early years of that play.
Well, and so when you talk to somebody in June and then you talk to somebody in October who contradicts or varies somewhat from the what the person in June says, do you have to go back to the person in June and say, hey, person in October just said this?
No, not usually. I mean, the structure of the oral history is that you let people have their say, and then you use the contradictions to highlight, you know, the differences in those storytelling. It was something like that. You know, we did our best to fact check it, which is to say we would, you know, go against the published record. We would ask Tony, what's your memory of this? But in the end, we weren't, for a lot of these discrepancies, we weren't able to tease apart who really knew the truth, and people stood by their stories.
One of the messages from these interviews is that there really doesn't seem to be anyone in the orbit of this work who was not profoundly affected by it.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't hard to get people to tell these stories to us. It wasn't like we approached people and they, you know, 2 weeks later wrote us back with a lukewarm, oh, I guess I sort of remember Angels in America. This was a signal moment in people's lives and their political lives and their artistic lives and their personal lives. And so people were hungry to tell these stories because the play and the experience of creating it or having a hand in creating it so defined their lives and careers for decades to come, whether it was people who, you know, like Tony himself or like Oscar Eustace, the co-director of the play in Los Angeles in 1992, or George Wolfe, the director of the play on Broadway, whether they were people whose careers were made by this production and this play, or it was people who were in an early workshop and then got fired and never put their hands on that play again. Those people had equal stakes, they felt, in the creation of this signature artistic event of the 20th and 21st century, and it had similar impact on both of their lives.
You know, there are going to be people who see the revival of this on Broadway or maybe read this book or any of the other, you know, attention being paid to it, who might think of this period as almost ancient history, which is difficult to believe for any of us Gen Xers in the crowd. But can you give us some perspective, you know, on the before here? What was the depiction of gays in popular culture? How are they represented in popular culture before Angels in America?
They weren't really represented. If they were represented, it was either as clowns, right, as sort of funny gay sidekicks, or as monsters, like the great example is the killer in Silence of the Lambs. That is the way that gay culture sort of made its way into the mainstream at that point. Emily Nussbaum, the TV critic for The New Yorker, talks in our book about how hungry she and her friends were for examples of queer representation in media, that they had to resort to, you know, watching Melrose Place and being so thrilled when the C-level gay character in Melrose Place got a subplot on one episode where he got to kiss someone. And even then, it was displayed as if the camera could barely even look for more than a second before it had to pan away. And so to have this play, which burst onto the scene in 1992 and 1993, I can't overstate the extent to which this play was everywhere when it was on Broadway. It was in the pop press and the cultural press and even the highbrow intellectual press. They were writing stories about it in the New York Review of Books. To have this play, which centered the American experience, the American story on gay men and their lives, which made an argument that you can't understand American history, 20th century American history, without understanding the crucial role that gay men play at the center of it, was huge, was revolutionary.
Well, and it's so interesting because as we're having this conversation, there's a feature on Tony Kushner in today's New York Times, or at least online in today's New York Times, and they did a piece on your book as well. But you make the point, or other people make the point as you speak with them, that really the AIDS crisis wasn't even portrayed in the New York Times for years.
Oh, yeah. There was you couldn't use the word gay in the New York Times until the late 80s or early 90s. And though the New York Times famously ran the first mainstream media report on what was then known, just thought of as a gay cancer, but which later became known as AIDS, they, like most mainstream media, did a very poor job of covering the epidemic in the 1980s. And they mostly covered it as exclusively a gay disease and one that had no impact on what they believed to be mainstream culture. And, you know, first Larry Kramer's play, The Normal Heart, in the mid-80s, and then Tony's play, Angels in America, were, among many other things, pushbacks against what they viewed as a marginalization of this crisis that was destroying their culture from the bottom up in the mainstream media.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I use the term ancient history to some people, but in some ways, the circumstances out of which Angels in America arose are not even necessarily, Donald Trump is elected as you're writing this book, which you know, there's this, I guess, cosmic connection between Roy Cohn and Donald Trump, is there not?
I would not even call it a cosmic. I would call it a very nitty-gritty, earthy connection, which is that Roy Cohn was Donald Trump's mentor. You know, Roy Cohn is famously a character in the play Angels in America, is being played by Nathan Lane on Broadway in this revival that's opening soon. And he's Roy Cohn was a closeted gay man. He died of AIDS. But before he got really sick, he was a power broker in the 1980s New York legal and cultural scenes. Donald Trump learned at his feet. He learned how to intimidate and bully a judge or the justice system. He learned to be an aggressive litigator, to threaten and cajole and go to court if you have to get the things that you want. And then when Roy Cohn became sick and it became clear that Roy Cohn was gay, the Donald Trump of the mid-80s ditched him and left him in the dirt and went on to his own career. But yeah, you know, the when we started this project, Barack Obama was president, and the moral arc of history was moving forever in a more progressive direction, and Donald Trump's candidacy was a joke. And then when we finished the book, Donald Trump was president, and it seemed like a lot of the battles that we thought had been won, that many of us thought had been won in the 90s and the 2000s, were in fact still being fought, still being, in the way that Roy Cohn would prefer us to think about it, litigated. And so that was the terrain, those difficult 80s, and a terrain in which gay people were being marginalized and killed, and progressive culture felt as if it was lost. That was the terrain that Angels in America sprang out of. That was what the world was like when Tony Kushner was writing it. And so to have this book come out in a world that seems surprisingly similar to that culture of the late 80s and early 90s, it was a real shock, but one that I think makes the book a more potent document for a lot of readers.
How did your own feelings about Angels in America evolve over the time you were doing this project?
But I would say both broadly and narrowly. Broadly, I became more and more convinced of the case that we sort of set out to make, but that I felt a little unsure of at the beginning, which is that you can make a real case for Angels in America as the defining work of American art of the last 30 years, that it contains all the sort of arcs of our culture over these last 30 years, and that it was a soothsaying work in its day and now serves both as a kind of crystal ball of our future and a very focused look at our past and where we have been. I've become more and more convinced of that over time. Narrowly, I've become more convinced of something that if you had told, you know, college age me who first encountered these plays, I never would have believed, which is the play, you know, is split into two parts. Part one, Millennium Approaches, and part two, Perestroika. I've become more convinced that Perestroika, in all its messiness and its unfinishedness, is a greater work of art, even if as a play, it can be a lot more difficult to sit through, especially if you end up in a bad production of it. I love that it's a great unfinished work about the way that humanity is itself a great unfinished work.
Dan Kois, it's a great work that you have done in compiling all this really interesting stuff, and thank you so much for sharing some of it with us.
Thanks a lot.
Milwaukee native Dan Kois is an editor at Slate and the co-author, along with Isaac Butler, of The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America. There's more information about the book at WUWM.com.
A new sports franchise will call a Milwaukee ice rink home beginning this fall. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Hockey fans in Milwaukee have cheered on the minor league Milwaukee Admirals for several generations. The franchise plays its home games at the UWM Panther Arena downtown, but the owners of a new team on the scene believe there's enough interest in hockey here to draw fans to a venue on the city's south side.
The Milwaukee Power is a junior hockey team that's a high-level amateur league that's relocated to the city from Atlanta. The team will play its games at Milwaukee County's Wilson Park Ice Arena, and the team's management says it'll play an important role not only in attracting fans to the games, but in supporting talented hockey players from the region. Chase Ernst is vice president of hockey operations for the team. We spoke with him at the team's official launch event this week, and he explained why this is the right time and Milwaukee is the right place for the team.
Milwaukee is the right place for this team because simply of the sheer void inside the hockey community of the junior level being here. However, more so than just that void is the fact that Milwaukee is a tremendous hockey community. So much history through so many youth organizations into the high school levels, and obviously with the collegiate success of the Badgers and the reputation of them. This is a hockey state, and this is a hockey city. And we just felt that the city of Milwaukee was ready to support this from naturally the youth hockey standpoint, but also from the sponsor corporate engagement through the youth game channeled via us through some sponsorship opportunities that we just tend to generate a little bit more easily because of fan base and things of that nature through our junior level exposure.
For people who don't necessarily fully know the structure of the hockey organizational world, where does junior hockey fit in, and where does this tier fit in junior hockey?
It's a great question. So junior hockey is a complicated landscape, and there are three levels of junior classifications that USA Hockey uses. Tier one is the highest level of junior hockey. There is one sanctioned tier one league in the country, the United States Hockey League. There is the Tier 2 level, which is represented by one league as well, the North American Hockey League. That is where we kind of come in with our branding, because the NA3HL is one of three USA Hockey sanctioned Tier 3 leagues falling under the branding inside the NA. And therefore, junior hockey's classifications ultimately segment not necessarily talent of player. Naturally, yes, a tier one player is a little bit more talented than a tier three player. However, it's a little bit more with just the regionalization of the sport and a little bit more in markets that are predominantly smaller and rural in nature, because they tend to do well with draws, okay? And therefore, junior hockey, unlike youth, is a for-profit level inside the sport. You know, there's some financial differences between the tiering. In regards to our players, junior hockey is a place for any player under the age of 21 years of age. So our players will consist of players from age 20 all the way down to potentially 16. We will have a host of players who naturally live outside of the Milwaukee area who are coming from other parts of the country to participate or get their start in junior hockey at the Tier 3 level. And it's our mission and job to try to advance those players either onto the Tier 2 or Tier 1 levels if they have subsequent junior time remaining, eligibility that is, or more so for those that are aging out, try to find them a Division 1 or a Division 3 college opportunity.
So to answer maybe an obvious question, while it's a for-profit league, the players are still amateurs.
Correct, yes. So junior hockey in the United States is an amateur status playing level. So all of these players maintain their NCAA eligibility. All of these players have aspirations of playing college hockey. Our job is to help them get there.
So the rink where you're playing, Wilson Ice Arena, it's home to the Shaw Club, or at least part of the Shaw Club. There are a number of different clubs around the Milwaukee area. Where does the Milwaukee Power fit in with all the various other hockey opportunities that already exist in Milwaukee?
You know, we had a roundtable discussion before our press conference, and we invited all of the youth hockey organizations inside our Wisconsin Region 5. We had a very good participation. And we addressed a lot of systemic issues that are impacting all of those youth hockey organizations. The Milwaukee Power pledged right then and there to address these systemic issues inside our sport, to be the organization that is fortunate enough inside the junior level to sit, per se, on top of the youth level. And by just that sheer pecking order, somehow, some way, hopefully a little bit more of a trust and confidence in the messaging that's coming down, trickling into the youth programs that we're involved with, shows through example the right ways to do things, the right ways to culture players, the right ways to just simply build a love of the game inside those appropriate youth organizations, and then hopefully provide a pathway for those players and families who start looking for more opportunity, start looking for more exposure, start looking for more education. Now they have an organization here in Milwaukee that they can physically connect the dots. They can see how their player's journey could go potentially now from youth to junior to college, where in the past, as you know, there was no junior level, therefore the journey couldn't be seen. And when you don't know what you're getting involved with, you tend to sometimes not make the journey. And therefore, we feel this team is going to serve so many good connecting pieces of the Milwaukee youth puzzle, both in player advancement, player development, but most importantly, we hope, family education of the pecking order of hockey.
The arena here, Wilson Ice Arena, it's a public facility. How does the Milwaukee Power play and share with all the other clubs that use this, whether they're high school clubs or Shaw or even the figure skating club that calls this home?
Yeah, well, that's really a testament to us being hockey people who understand our place in the greater community. Outside ownership groups perhaps come in here with no ties to the local community, not knowing the people involved with those entities that you just said. Well, it's a probably different messaging from them, and there's probably a little bit more headbutting. Us, be it that we have lifelong friendships with these individuals that are in control of those entities, we're very confident that through the collaboration and bringing those partners in, educating them through full transparency of what our ownership group's about, who our ownership group is, what it is that we're looking to do, not just at the junior level for ourselves, but also for the community as a whole, that trust and confidence gets built. And that trust and confidence we've seen in the hockey world is everything. And unfortunately, a lot of junior programs in the past in other markets haven't earned that. We're going to be the example of the junior market and the junior organization that does things right inside the youth community, builds that trust and confidence. So issues like ice availability aren't going to be issues that can't be solved, compromised on, and worked around.
A lot of work to do between now and September?
That's an understatement. But I'll tell you what, I'm excited. And I think if you were here at this press conference today, if you really understand how this started, we have created this brand, this organization, from absolutely nothing. And there's been a tremendous amount of work that's gone on naturally behind the scenes. And I'm thankful every day for the people that we have involved inside our Power staff, because without the people, the Power just simply doesn't exist. So yes, we are busy. We are officially open for business. Obviously, we have, 3 months until our opening camp, training camp starts, 2 months to our tryout camp. Yeah, busy is an understatement, but I'm excited for us. I'm excited for the city of Milwaukee, and I'm really looking forward to getting things going.
Chase Ernst, good luck.
Thank you so very much.
Chase Ernst is Vice President of Hockey Operations for the Milwaukee Power, a junior hockey team that will play at the Wilson Park Ice Arena beginning this fall. The team is part of the NA3HL League, and you can find more information about it at WUWM.com.
One last break now, and then we'll chat with Dave Fandle about his four-decade quest to interview the screen legends of Hollywood's golden age. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The golden age of Hollywood ran from 1929, when the talkies were introduced, to the 1960s. Film stars were groomed and promoted by a studio system that could be both supportive and exploitive. When the studios began to break up in the 1960s, many of the stars they made famous were entering their old age. Some were still working by the late 70s. Others were happily or not retired, but they were still accessible to fans in a way that today's celebrities aren't.
And that's where our next guest comes in. For the past four decades, Dave Fantel has been asking for and getting interviews with some of Hollywood's best-loved stars. And those interviews have finally been published in a book called Hollywood Heyday, 75 Candid Interviews with Golden Age Legends. Dave, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Good to see you, Bonnie.
And normally I'm seeing you in a very different context, but in this case, it's about something you're doing and have done for 40 years.
It's my avocation and not my vocation, because you're right. My day job, I'm chief marketing officer for UPAF, United Performing Arts Fund. But for the past 40 plus years, my outside passion has been the Golden Age of Hollywood.
Well, and you started as a teenager in the Twin Cities, somehow deciding that it was perfectly cool to write to all of these famous people and say, hey, we'd like to interview you. Now, this is done with a friend.
Yes.
And somehow they said yes.
Pretty astonishing when you think about it today, right? So, and I tell audiences, and they're just can't believe it. When we saw That's Entertainment very briefly in 1974, the compilation of all the great MGM movie musicals, we were 15 years old, living in St. Paul, and we became sort of hooked on the classics. So here we were about to graduate high school in 1978, and as you said, my friend and co-writer Tom Johnson and I said, you know, many stars of the Golden Age are in their golden years, but they're still very much alive. And would it be possible to actually meet them? So we did. Today seems pretty outrageous. We would actually send a letter with a self-addressed stamped envelope to the home addresses of people like Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly.
Well, how did you find the home addresses?
Well, back then there were actually source books that told you that Gene Kelly was at 725 North Rodeo Drive and Fred Astaire was on San Ysidro Drive. And you know how you got stars' homes maps and different things like that? So you could get access to their home addresses. So we'd put the postage on, the self-addressed stamped envelope, and lo and behold, they would respond. Now, they wouldn't always respond in the affirmative, but they would respond. And in the case of Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly, in the summer or just before the summer of 1978, they green-lighted visits to Los Angeles. So here we were, literally June of 1978. So 40 years ago, almost to this date, we made this first sojourn via St. Paul to Los Angeles to interview the screen legends Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly.
And you couldn't have started with two better people.
Exactly. Or more
age,
revered.
Or more revered.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And because they were so revered, and having that photo taken with Fred Astaire, it opened so many doors for us. And over 200 interviews followed, and about 60 of them happened between 78 and 83 when we were college journalists for the Minnesota Daily, which was a large daily newspaper at the University of Minnesota. And don't forget, and you know, Bonnie, 35, 40 years ago, stars from the golden era were 35, 40 years closer than they are today. So it was not unheard of for us as college students to have film societies and to appreciate the golden age of Hollywood. It's a bigger leap today with younger audiences, and I certainly can vouch for that. Teaching some film classes at Marquette, that it is really an education to get them to see some of the classics today.
Well, and a slight digression, some of the classics, I think of Busby Berkeley and the kinds of film techniques that were developed. I mean, they were revolutionary at the time, and in some ways they still are. So there's a lot to learn. It's not just enjoyment to go back. If you're actually a film scholar or you're studying it, there's a lot to see and a lot to learn.
Exactly. And, you know, it's really incumbent upon young people, if they're interested in that field, to know its history. And you'd be astonished to know that they don't know Charlie Chaplin or they don't know John Ford. And you're exactly right. The work of these artists paved the way. I mean, who idolizes John Ford more than a Steven Spielberg? So it's very important to know. And in our book, Rod Steiger told the story. Here he is, won an Academy Award for In the Heat of the Night, playing this sort of racist Southern sheriff. And he was reinventing himself toward the end of his life in the mid-90s. He found himself talking to these young studio executives that maybe had a business MBA from an Ivy League school. And the question they would ask Rod Steiger is, can you do a Southern accent? No clue about the industry's history.
Well, and even though you didn't set out to write an industry history, in a way you have. And, you know, looking at all of the different folks you got to talk to, anyone who loves movies would be sitting there going, oh, I wish I could have been in the room. Was there ever anyone who disappointed you?
No. No one disappointed us because I think they were groomed on the studio system, so they were always very media and fan-friendly when it became to accessibility. I think when Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly opened the door, and our book, Hollywood Heyday, is simply dedicated to Fred and Gene, because we wouldn't be talking about this subject, I wouldn't be at Marquette and what have you, if it wasn't for those first two meetings with Astaire and Kelly. The genius of Fred Astaire is the fact that he was so unaware of his genius. He had no interest in dissecting or really talking about things that he did 20, 30, 40, 50 years earlier. And was there a greater artist, a greater genius in the field of dance than Fred Astaire? But he was totally unaware of it.
Well, and what was interesting in that particular interview, he did talk about how they did that dancing on the ceiling scene, but he was more talking about not what he did, but what all the tech people had to do, and the cameraman had to do.
And that's the famous scene from Royal Wedding where the room moved with the camera, and one of the last survivors of that golden age is the director of that sequence, Stanley Donen, who about 30 years after he did the sequence with Astaire, did Dancing on the Ceiling with Lionel Richie. The exact same technique, not using computers, not using high tech, just did the same thing that they did in 1952 in Royal Wedding.
One of the ones I found most interesting was your conversation with Lucille Ball. Mm-hmm. You talk about finding her very, not prickly, but direct. Mm-hmm. And did that surprise you when you arrived at her house?
Well, sometimes you went to the funny people thinking that they would be on and they would be funny. And it was certainly true with people like Milton Berle and George Burns, or Mel Brooks for that matter. But in the case of two iconic comedic stars, and that's Lucille Ball and Bob Hope, they were probably two of the least funny people you'd ever meet. The reason I think Lucille Ball was not particularly funny is she really broke the glass ceiling for women in the entertainment industry. And people forget that she started Desilu Productions with her husband at the time, Desi Arnaz. She was more of a businesswoman in a male-dominated environment beyond just performing in I Love Lucy. And when we asked her about ad-libbing and slapstick and all the craziness, she said, first of all, I want to make it clear, there were very few episodes in which we did the shtick and the slapstick, even though we remember that. And she said, as it pertains to the script and the stories, the writers knew our characters intimately. There was no ad-libbing. And by 1968, she sold Desilu Productions to the parent company of Paramount Pictures for, at that time, the princely sum of $18 million. So she was extremely savvy, extremely smart in a male-dominated environment, and not particularly funny. And I think the transition to Bob Hope, definitely one of the great comedic icons and entertainment icons of the 20th century, but he was known to be incredibly media accessible, but to really say nothing. We had him for a long interview late at night when he was in the Twin Cities, and he was shockingly frank with us about films he liked, films he didn't like, and it was shortly after Reagan was shot, and he, as a well-known conservative, came out as a strong advocate for gun control. And those are the subject matters he actually talked about in our interview, which is certainly not characteristic of the Bob Hope that was interviewed by many other media outlets.
Right, the Vanity Fair type of things, or a Hollywood Reporter, or one of
those. Ask him a question and he would be oblivious to the question and promote the show. That was typically what Bob Hope did.
Why do you think people were so honest with you and so open? Not just accessibility, but to actually get those kinds of interviews.
Well, I think in some respects we had youth on our side, especially for that first round of interviews while we were college students. The other thing that we did, Bonnie, is that because of sort of the golden age of Hollywood, we actually bought our first suits in the Twin Cities. And so there wasn't an interview that we didn't go to back in those days where we didn't afford these people the respect of coming with a suit and tie on. And I think the fact that we were young and had an inordinate amount of knowledge on their careers helped in comparison to maybe some young journalists today who might be interviewing a celebrity, like, let's say, Jerry Lewis or something a year or two ago, who would really have no sense of their history or really what to ask. Robert Wagner, who wrote our foreword, was a perfect example. That came about just a couple years ago when we got to RJ, what he lets us call him. The publicist said, you know, you have 30 minutes. She would check in 30 minutes and go, we're having a great time, go away. Over 2 hours elapsed. And it not only was such a rich interview that's in the book, but he said, can I write the foreword? So I think the fact that he was probably used to people interviewing about playing in Austin Powers and things like that, that for someone to go back and talk to him about working with John Ford in What Price Glory, he was pleasantly surprised.
I think in some ways, my sense of it, having read the book now, is that you disarmed them. And it's true with interviews today. Most people don't get below the surface. Mm-hmm. They want, you know, they say, tell me about your book, as opposed to having read your book.
Yeah, and I remember when we first met Gene Kelly in 78, and then we had a second interview at his home the second time, probably 15 years later. And the first thing he said, and here we were, what, 35 to 40 years old, the first thing he said is, the college boys are back. So it's like 15 years had not elapsed.
Is there one that got away that you are sorry that you didn't get into the book?
Well, I have a fun note because it shows the accessibility of these stars of the Golden Age. A handwritten note from Henry Fonda that said, I'm sorry I won't be in L.A. when you're here. I'll be in New Hampshire making a movie. And, of course, it was on Golden Pond when he won an Academy Award, finally. And so I think it shows a little bit to the class and personality. But, I mean, certainly, you know, the fact that we couldn't get to Johnny Carson, that we couldn't get to a John Wayne, that you couldn't get to a Katharine Hepburn, or an Orson Welles. There were certainly stars of great artists that we didn't get to, but when we look back at the 200 plus and the 75 that are in the book, we're pretty pleased by who we did manage to meet.
I know this is Hollywood heyday and golden age, but have you thought about doing this now? Are there people who interest you now that you'd want to talk to?
Well, there are certainly people of that ilk that are in the golden age of now, like a De Niro, a Pacino, a Dustin Hoffman,
a Streep.
But the reality is, Bonnie, it's a different day. Their accessibility is still, because of the handlers, because of the entourage that shields them, you can't go into them and get the kind of access that we had, you know, going back 30 and 40 years. And it's a shame. And so to say we've retired from interviewing individual celebrities is pretty much an accurate description because, again, we really have no much more interest because, and you know, working with celebrities and publicists, the publicists of today, I'm sad to say, having worked in public relations for decades, they've taken the fun out of it. And I don't want to work with these young publicists anymore. They're just very difficult.
So this is
this is the final wrapping.
I was going to say, this is the final wrap, and that's your golden age.
It's our golden age, and it is a wrap. And we understand that it is a niche audience. But I am pleased to do a lot of speaking to, you know, at senior facilities. So those are people who actually lived this. I went to a retirement facility, and a woman came up to me and said, I was Charlton Heston's teacher at New Trier High School in Wilmette, Illinois. Now, of course, she was in her late 90s, but it was incredibly lucid, and it was great that she came up to me. But then the other side of the scale is I have an opportunity to equate young college students at Marquette with some of these Golden Age classics. And surprisingly, some of them actually come up to me and compare notes with their grandparents and said, I saw Casablanca last night, or my grandpa knew Bing Crosby from Spokane, Washington. So it's very fulfilling to have that kind of feedback, even from the younger people.
So it goes on. Even though this is a wrap, it continues.
It goes on.
Well, Dave Fannell, it is so great to talk to you about something other than UPAF, even though UPAF is a wonderful thing to talk about. But best of luck with the book. Thank you so much for coming in.
Anytime. Thanks, Bonnie.
Dave Fannell is Director of Marketing for the United Performing Arts Fund. His passion is the Golden Age of Hollywood, and his new book is called Hollywood Heyday, 75 Candid Interviews with Golden Age Legends.
He'll speak about it Thursday night at the Jewish Community Center in Whitefish Bay. There's more information at WUWM.com. And that is all for Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.